Shalom. This is a re-recording of a lesson I gave on Shabbat, November 26th, Parshat Chayei Sara. It was Thanksgiving weekend, so Pastor Lancaster was out of town, and I'm Aaron Eby, and I was filling in for him. So we were studying Parshat Chayei Sara, and Chayei Sara means the life of Sara, which is interesting because it begins with Sara's death, not her life. You know, it goes into her burial and things like that. And it's kind of an interesting thing to ponder. What does this Parsha have to do with her life? But it reminded me of what our Master Yeshua said, proving the resurrection from the Torah. He quoted the verse that said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, right? And then he reasons, God is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. You know, and the sages tell us that even in their death, the tzaddikim are able to influence the world, and in a way, able to influence the world even more so than they are when they're alive. But I'd like to talk more about the story of Rebecca and Isaac and their meeting and their marriage. You know, we talk in this country about biblical marriage, and we talk, or, you know, critics of the Bible will say, well, what's biblical marriage? And they'll point to a lot of different examples of things that are really not normative for us, nor should they be. Whether it's David producing 100 Philistine foreskins for Saul or whatever, you know, things like that. But in this week's Parsha, the meeting of Rebekah and Isaac, this is the story that provides the most information for and the most guidance for courtship, matchmaking, marriage in the Jewish community. So in secular society and in Christian communities, it doesn't really match so much what's going on here, but it really is informative in the Jewish world. So I'd like to look at that and see what it can teach us and see how we can improve our process of meeting our spouse and being married. So I'll give you a little overview of the story just to have it in our minds. So Abraham asks his servant, by the way, his servant, we know he has a servant named Eliezer, but in this story, he's never named. And there's a reason why he's not named, and that has to do with how he's really just submitting himself to Abraham and being a true shaliach, a true representative of Abraham. But so anyway, Abraham asks his servant to go find a wife for Isaac from the land of Abraham's birthplace, but not to take one from among the Canaanites. And he also insists that his servant cannot take Isaac there and that God will help by sending his angel. So the servant heads out to Mesopotamia, to Paddan Aram, heads to the well at the city at the time when women come out to get water. So he prays to God at that time for assistance and for a sign that the one who gives water to him and to his camels would be the one that God selected as a wife for Isaac. Just then, Rebekah comes out and offers water to him and to his camels. And so he's still wondering, is she really the one? So he gives her some jewelry, asks who she is, and if she has a place to stay. And she not only offers a place to stay, but also feed for the camels. And then the man reveals that he is the servant of Abraham. So she runs home to tell the family. Laban comes out, ushers the servant in, you know, seeing the limousine or whatever, you know. He's very impressed. They make him comfortable, give him something to eat. But he says, I won't eat until you let me speak my piece. And so then he tells them about his mission to find a wife for Isaac. And so when Laban and Bethuel hear the story, they say, well, this is from God. How can we argue? How can we agree or disagree with what obviously came from God? And they tell him to take Rebekah home as a wife for Isaac. So the servant brings out gifts and he spends the night. And so he gets ready to go the next morning. And her brother and her mother want to delay it. Doesn't want her to leave right away. But the servant insists they have to get moving. And they ask Rebekah if she will go. And she consents. So they send her and her nurse along with Abraham, or servant of Abraham, and along with his men. So they arrive back in the land of Canaan. Isaac had just come back and was out walking and praying in the field when he saw the camels coming. When Rebekah sees him, she falls off the camel and says, "Who is that?" And the servant tells her that it's Isaac. So she puts on the veil. And the servant explains the situation to Isaac. And then in verse 67 here, it concludes the story. It says, "Then Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her." So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Now, as I read the story, I had lots and lots of questions. I mean, as we read, Isaac took Rebekah, she became his wife, and he loved her. I mean, first of all, isn't it obvious that he loved her? I mean, why would he marry her if he didn't love her? And for that matter, the order is all wrong. It's supposed to say that he loved her, and then it should say that he took her to be his wife, right? And why did Abraham insist that Isaac was not supposed to marry a Canaanite anyway? I mean, you might say, well, because they're cursed from back in the days of Noah, but I'm not satisfied with that answer. I mean, first of all, it was Canaan who was cursed to be a slave to his uncles, Shem and Japheth. And I have a hard time understanding this to mean that Canaan fathered a cursed race of people that's good for nothing but to be slaves. That just doesn't seem to match a biblical worldview in general. And there's no redemption for them? I mean, like if Ruth escapes the judgment against the Moabites by being female and by joining the Jewish people through marriage and personal commitment to God, why couldn't a Canaanite do that? I mean, and plus, despite the curse against Canaan, there is no directive, there's no command to anyone yet saying not to marry Canaanites. Actually, if you look at many of the commentators accept, based on the plain reading of the text, that several of the sons of Jacob actually married Canaanites. I mean, it's not like they all went back to Abraham's homeland to get wives. And that included Tamar, according to Genesis 38:2. Which would mean that Messiah himself would have had Canaanite ancestry. Now, you might say, well, it's because the Canaanites were idolaters. But guess what? So were the members of Abraham's extended family. Everyone was basically an idolater at that time. And yet, you know, not every Canaanite was a bad person. Abraham had business dealings with several Canaanites who seemed like good people. Avner, Eshcol, Mamre, etc. I mean, best we could tell, his servant Eliezer was a Canaanite too. So what was the real problem with Isaac marrying a Canaanite? I mean, really, how did Abraham ever expect to find a match for his son at all? I mean, you think it's bad here in Hudson, Wisconsin, and in Messianic Judaism, where the pickings are slim. I mean, imagine being Abraham, who is seriously the only game in town. What young woman could possibly be out there who was qualified to marry Isaac, the first man in the world to be circumcised on the eighth day, offered as a pure sacrifice to God, the only, you might say, from birth person to exist? Abraham's servant seems to have that same hesitation, like, how is he going to find? But Abraham was seemingly very confident that this was going to happen. I mean, I think Abraham reasoned, knowing that God was going to raise up spiritual seed through Isaac, and, you know, if he's going to raise him back from the dead, he's also going to find him a wife who would be the perfect woman. So Abraham had a lot of faith. I also have a subtle question based on the Hebrew of the story. The word isha literally means woman or wife. And when it means woman, I mean, it strongly implies a grown woman who is married, not a young woman who is ready to be married. Right, so it means wife, right? So it makes sense for Abraham to tell a servant, find a wife for my son, because that implies, find me a single young lady who can become my son's wife. But as the story goes on, they keep on referring to this hypothetical candidate as an isha, a wife. So the servant says, perhaps the wife may not be willing to follow me to this land. Abraham says, but if the isha, if the wife is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. So why are they calling that reject candidate who never actually gets married to Isaac a wife, rather than calling her a maiden or a young lady? And then is the servant, really, this has always bothered me, the servant is supposed to just give up after the first try? He finds one person, he gets rejected, and that's it. He's done. He doesn't have to find a wife for Isaac anymore. But all right, I have some questions about Rebekah as well. As the commentaries note, Laban and Betuel were really scoundrels. They're not good people. I mean, how in the world did Rebekah end up to be such an amazing person? How was it possible for her to step immediately into the life of Abraham's family? I mean, like, she was able to just fill the tent of Sarah. How is that possible? The sages call Rebekah a rose among thorns. How did she learn that good behavior in such a challenging environment? I mean, Abraham was a convert, so to speak. I mean, he was raised in idolatry and then later turned to the service of God. Isaac, on the other hand, was, like I said, from birth. He was raised as an observant, God-fearing person. Okay, so what about Rebekah? Was she more like Abraham, like a convert? Or was she raised observant? You know, and if she was still non-God-fearing, non-observant at the time when Eliezer came to visit her, then what made her such a good match? Or how did she become a follower of God? Furthermore, how did Abraham's servant arrive at that particular sign that would identify the match for Isaac? I mean, was it just like a superstitious omen? Was it like rolling dice or something? Or was it some sort of litmus test? Was he trying to identify some form of personal character in the candidate? I mean, if it was a character test, why that particular feature of giving water rather than some, I don't know, a theological question, like, how do you feel about worshiping the one true God? But so conveniently, he happens to take advantage of the situation by making the test something that would benefit him personally, having this young girl give water to all his camels. Now, maybe you heard the Midrash that says that Rebekah was only 3 years old at the time all this happened. And you need to know that that is just a homiletical point. It's a symbolic Midrash. It's not history. It's not Peshat. And it's not the plain meaning of the text. There's no good reason for anyone to accept that as literal truth. It communicates something symbolic. The good news is that even though that Midrash is very popular, it's one taught in schools, specifically because it's so bizarre, so fanciful, it captures your attention, makes you wonder, you know. But the good news is there are other more reasonable traditions in that matter. You know, another strong Midrash says that she was 14 at the time, which fits the narrative better and the Hebrew words that are used a lot better. You don't call a 3-year-old a maiden, right? And although in the context of our culture, it would still be weird and inappropriate, not to mention illegal in many states, for a 40-year-old man to marry a 14-year-old maiden, it made sense and it would have been normative in that time and place. And there is one detail in the story that makes a grown-up Rebekah seem weird, though. I mean, in Genesis 24:59, we read, "So they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men." Her nurse? Okay, the word nurse in Hebrew is menika, which is literally breastfeeder. I mean, that's a wet nurse. Why would a grown maiden need a wet nurse? I mean, for that matter, why would a 3-year-old need a wet nurse? So we learn more about this woman, Rebekah's nurse, at the end of her life. In Genesis 35, starting in verse 6, we read, "And Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And there he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried under an oak below Bethel." So he called its name Alon Bachut. And so that phrase, Alon Bachut, in Hebrew means oak of crying. Wow, I mean, this woman, this nurse, seems to have an extraordinary amount of honor in Jacob's family. And also, we learn here her name was Deborah. Now, the Midrashim don't have a lot to say about her, but there are strong hints that the more famous Deborah that we all know of from the time of the Judges may have been named after this woman. But there's one fascinating detail in the Aramaic version of the scriptures and Targum Yonatan specifically regarding Rebecca's nurse Deborah, where the Hebrew has this word menika, a wet nurse. The Aramaic says pedagogta, which is actually a Greek loan word from the word that from which we get pedagogue. So in other words, Deborah was not so much Rebecca's wet nurse, according to the Targum, at that age. She was her mentor. Maybe she was her nurse at the time she was little and then grew to be her more of a nanny, more of a mentor, more of a tutor. Now, I like to think and imagine that Deborah caught the vision of the one true creator God, and she started researching and Googling this God and finding out his qualities and expectations and training Rebecca to be a God-fearer, a kind and honest, giving, caring person, exceptionally pure in the middle of a spiritually dark environment. And that, if it was really Deborah's influence, it would make Rebecca, like Isaac, a person raised as a God-fearer. And that seems to make so much sense to me. I mean, you might think, though, that Isaac had it bad and felt alone in the world. Imagine what it must have been like to be Rebecca. I mean, the only godly person in the world that she knows is Deborah, her mentor. And yet, God had a plan for her too. When the opportunity arose for Rebecca to come home to Hudson, to join the household of Abraham, she knew just what to do. And Abraham was a man of spiritual vision. I mean, he had no doubt in his mind that Rebecca was out there. I mean, obviously so. If it's through Isaac that Abraham would bear his spiritual progeny. And he knew that she, from the very beginning, was chosen, already chosen from heaven to be Isaac's wife. So Eliezer's mission was not to find eligible girls. His job was not to bring home a nice maiden for Isaac, or to find Isaac a girlfriend. He was sent to find Isaac's wife. And that's why Abraham insists on calling her this even before she is married to him. I mean, that should be encouraging and instructive for those among us who are looking for their Rebecca or for their Isaac. I mean, remember, your goal is not to meet girls. It's not to meet guys. Your goal is not to find a decent guy or an eligible lady or a girlfriend or a boyfriend. Your goal is to find your husband, to find your wife. You know, according to Jewish custom and belief, there is a match made in heaven. In Yiddish, it's called a bashert. So when you pray, you don't ask God to send eligible bachelors or single young ladies your way. Get to the point and ask God to lead you to your wife or to your husband. Well, how do you know who that person is? How do you identify your husband or your wife among all the eligible people out there? I mean, do you hand out a Myers-Briggs personality test and then analyze your potential combination? Heavens no. No, you might as well consult a horoscope if you're going to go that route. I mean, personalities will affect the character of your marriage, but it does not determine whether it will be a successful marriage or not. I mean, for the right match, you need to be looking at two traits of compatibility and one primary trait of readiness. So the first compatibility trait is values. Do you consider the same things to be valuable? What are you willing to spend your savings on? What are you willing to sacrifice for a greater cause? What are you willing to have taking up space in your house? What are you willing to have taking up your time? Because if your spouse does not share your values, you will be tempted to start staking out your claim and competing for resources. Your spouse will become your rival, and you will not become one in any meaningful sense. The second compatibility trait is closely related to this, and that's goals. If your dream in life is to be a lifelong missionary to orphans in Uganda, And her dream is to build the Messianic community in Hudson, Wisconsin. Somebody is going to feel very unfulfilled and unhappy. I mean, the rubber really hits the road when it comes to children. How many do you envision having? How will you educate them? What will you expect out of them? In my opinion, that's it. Those two things. All the rest are minor details and challenges that can be worked out. But if a person does not share your values and your goals, then that person's not meant for you, and it would be a mistake to pursue them hoping that at some point you can convince them to change. I mean, and then the remaining trait pertains more to readiness. How do you know if you are ready for marriage or that the person you are considering is ready? And there may be a few factors, but the number one indicator is a special kind of generosity. I mean, when you get married, you have to be ready to give everything away. And I'm talking about money for sure, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. You will be giving away your time, pretty much all of it. You will be giving away your space. I mean, you won't even know or understand the meaning of the word privacy anymore. These things will be given away not only to your spouse, but also to people you haven't met yet. Some very little people. These are people who will take and take and have neither the ability nor the decency to pay you back. And their very lives will depend on you. You think that by getting married, you'll finally be able to sleep in peace. Your life will be organized. Your house will be clean. You get to eat nice meals. No. You are actually signing away your rights to all of that for something greater, something more precious. And, you know, maybe you'll be able to keep some of that, but don't count on it. If you are ready to get married, that means that you are ready for your sense of self to be annihilated. I mean, today people think of marriage as self-actualization. It's so backwards. People think, I will be able to be my true self. I will be able to express my identity by marrying this person. But no, I mean, being ready to be married means you are ready to annihilate your own sense of self, to let go of the you that now exists, and to become a new you that includes another body and another soul. I think that this sense of selflessness in terms of time, space, and energy and resources was the key characteristic that gave Abraham's servant confidence that Rebekah was prepared to join the family of Abraham and Isaac. She came from obviously a wealthy family, but she didn't hold on to things. She wasn't territorial. She wasn't stingy. She was open with what she had. But why couldn't Rebekah have been a Canaanite? I mean, in this case, I'd say it has more to do with their specific situation. Maybe it may or may not apply to some of us. As the saying goes, you don't marry a person, but you marry an entire family. So if there were a Rebekah among the Canaanites, she might make a great match. But there would be simply no way to avoid influence from that extended family and the surrounding culture. The child would grow up identifying with Canaanites and thinking of themselves as like a half Canaanite. I mean, there's no way you could get away with not visiting grandma and grandpa and staying away from family events and family reunions and things like that. But by taking her away from her homeland, Rebekah herself, she may have come from a land of idolaters, but is not a Canaanite. She doesn't fit. She would naturally feel like an outsider to the surrounding Canaanite culture, just like Isaac did. And that's a good thing. And it's an essential thing in this case. And really, she had to go through that same process that Abraham went through when God told him, Lech Lecha, go for yourself. And she echoed this when they asked her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. And that going would provide a protective identity bubble for the children, even as they live and interact among the Canaanites. And that teaches us that it's important to be purposeful in instilling an identity in our children. And now, more than ever, I feel like our children should be outsiders to this culture. I mean, even though they may be proud of our country, dedicated to the welfare of their country, they still really should feel like outsiders to the culture. And that's difficult, and it requires a solid, strong community. It requires supportive parents, but it's really, really, really critical. But speaking of surrounding culture, there's something about the story that makes many people feel uncomfortable. There is no way that the story could be considered a normative example for us today, they say. After all, this is an arranged marriage. To people in this culture, that arranged marriage sounds primitive. It sounds disgusting. And in fact, it almost feels morally wrong to marry someone if you haven't already been swept away by romantic feelings for them and gotten to know them over the last decade or something. When I was a kid, we had snappy comebacks for everything. And that was pretty much mostly the fault of Pee-wee Herman, I think. But on the playground, you couldn't just say that you loved anything without someone always responding, "Well, then why don't you marry it?" I mean, in fact, there was an episode of Pee-wee's Playhouse where he said, "I love this fruit salad." And someone said, "Well, then why don't you marry it?" So he did. And you know, really, this has become in our culture. We've said this so many times. It's become this unquestionable axiom. You love, therefore you marry. If you love someone, you should marry them. You can't marry that person. "Well, but I love them." "Oh, well, what can I say?" And there's no way to answer that because we've ingrained it in our heads that if you love, that you have to marry. Through movies and fairy tales, we've fooled ourselves into thinking that this has always been a law of the universe. But in reality, it's actually kind of a luxury of modern society where marriage is no longer really a practical thing as much as it is a luxury, something that we just do for fun. But love, and by love I mean, when I say love, I'm talking about romantic or sexualized feelings of affection for another person. And that kind of love is a terrible reason to marry someone. A terrible reason. It's not magical. It's not even spiritual. It's not an indicator of compatibility or destiny or God's will. It's an indicator that you have a heart beating in your body, and you have blood flowing in your veins, that you have a brain and you've got glands and you've got a mind. It's a natural part of what it means to be a human being. And it comes easily, and it also goes away easily. It's one of the most unstable forces in our lives. And it toys with our judgment. It toys with our emotions. And at the same time, it's a wonderful gift. Isaac married Rebecca, confident that she was compatible with his mission in life and ready to share all that she had with him. And then he fell in love with her. Husbands, love your wives. That's what the scripture says, right? Husbands, love your wives. Husbands and wives should love one another. They should be in love with one another. Although that romantic love cannot be the foundation of their relationship or the marriage. It cannot be the glue that holds them together. An arranged marriage, though, doesn't mean a loveless marriage. I mean, it doesn't mean a forced marriage. It does not mean a child marriage. It means that the marriage was intentional, that the marriage involved coordinated efforts between individuals and the larger community, and it wasn't based on an emotional decision. An arranged marriage, it's vastly superior to a disarranged marriage, which some people seem to prefer. In Orthodox Judaism today, marriages are strongly modeled on the Isaac-Rebecca marriage. I mean, that includes, for example, the rule that marriage must be fully consensual, which also, by the way, implies an age of consent. And another rule in Orthodox Jewish society is that there has to be a broker, a matchmaker involved. In Hebrew, we call it a shadchan. And that is the role that the servant of Abraham played in this story. Now, I could explain more of the practical aspects of that. I don't have time. There's more I could say. But bottom line, I just want to call some things into question. I think that there's really something very wrong with the way our society conceptualizes love and marriage. It just doesn't work. The secular idea of marriage is completely melting down. And that idea, that secular idea of marriage, is our cultural default, even among religious people. And among followers of Yeshua, it seems like people know that they sense that that marriage is melting down, but they have no idea how deep the flaw in the system runs. Rediscovering a biblical view of marriage means calling into question some deeply held notions that are held by religious and secular people alike. I mean, granted, okay, most of us were married under the auspices of these cultural norms that I'm calling into question. You know, you fell in love, you had romantic dates, maybe you then broke up, and maybe you fell in love with someone else. Maybe you repeated that lots of times, and eventually you got married, and somehow that worked, and you've grown, and you're in a wonderful marriage. You've been married for 40 years. Mazel tov. In no way do I wish to make you feel guilty for this or to call into question God's plan for your life. And I know there are some people, too, that aren't married, that don't wish to be married, or that have been married, and then they're divorced and things like that. And God has plans for those people's lives. Maybe they will be married, maybe they won't. I don't want to call into question their validity as a member of the community as well. That is a path, a godly path for many people. But now, anyway, going forward, with all that said, going forward, now that the meaning and the purpose of marriage is changing so rapidly in our culture, can we rethink it for our child's sake, for our children's sake? Can we afford not to rethink it? And for us in the tiny cultural bubble that is Messianic Judaism, I feel like we find ourselves in a situation that is quite a bit like that of Abraham and Isaac and Rebekah. We can learn so much from their examples. In the meantime, may God bless all the married couples here with love and harmony and success. And may He bless those who are looking for their wife or husband to find success quickly. And may He bless all of us, every one of us, with love and friendships and warm community life. Quickly and soon. Amen.